All right, welcome everyone. Thanks for coming out, end of the day. I'm sure your brains are full. I'll try not to hurt them too bad. So this one is a lofty titled session, but basically the general idea behind this session is to cover some of the latest, greatest, cool stuff that's coming out in the ASP.NET arena. Some of which you may have seen in other sessions. If you went to Scott Hanselman, Scott Hunter's session the other day, there's a little bit of overlap here. The general context here is if you are an MVC developer or beginning to develop apps in MVC, what are the things that pertain to you directly, and what are some of the surrounding things in the ASP.NET space that you should be at least aware of, understand how they kind of work, and what they can do for you. In the back there, if you can reduce the volume just a little bit, the echo is a little loud. Okay. So let's just dive right into it here. My name is Brian Noyes. I'm from a company called Soliance. We do end-to-end project development, architecture consulting. We've got experts in a lot of different technologies available through our partner network. So if you've got projects, check us out and see if we can help you out. I'm also a Microsoft Regional Director. If you haven't been exposed to that program, it is a program somewhat similar to the MVP one. We work closely with product teams. We work closely with the senior leadership at Microsoft to give them feedback and help evangelize their products. Also a MVP in client development and a Pluralsight author. Have five actually in the moment now, a sixth course in the library. If you haven't checked out Pluralsight, I recommend you check them out. Go down to the booth they have in the expo hall and you can get a free 1 month pass from them. And some amazing content out there on Pluralsight as well. I'm as much of a consumer as I am a producer when it comes to Pluralsight. Also on a number of insider groups with different product teams, several of which overlap with the talk here with the web teams at Microsoft. And my contact information here, I've got it here and I've got it at the end of the deck as well. Feel free to contact me there. Okay, so what we're gonna go through today, we've got a whole bunch of different topics, some of which kind of interrelate with each other. Other ones are kind of standalone on their own. But we're gonna start with the one ASP.NET concept and make sure you're aware of that because that sort of changes the way you go about starting out your new projects with MVC. There's a number of new options there in the dialogues you gotta go through. So we'll step through that as our starting point. Then we'll take a look at Browser Link, which I know Scott covered the other day. So if you went to that session, I think they actually went a little deeper here because they didn't have quite as many topics to go through. But we'll make sure you're familiar with that. That's a nice feature that lets you basically have a bidirectional channel between Visual Studio and any number of browser instances you have open when you're doing a debugging session. And it lets you basically make edits on either the Visual Studio side and get the browsers to refresh without having to do a whole debug, you know, restart of cycles. And you can also now, with Web Essentials, go and make edits on the client side and actually have those synchronized to the back end, which is very nice. So I'll talk a little bit more about that and demonstrate that. Then we'll look at Bootstrap. One of the new features that came in with Visual Studio 2013 and MVC 5 is that Bootstrap is integrated into your MVC projects from the start. Now, it wasn't a huge big deal to go integrate it yourself in the past, but it just gives you a better starting point if you're not familiar with that framework to just kind of have it there and already helping you right when you get started. So we'll look at how that's integrated. We'll talk about attribute routing, which if you've been doing any MVC development, so first off, quick show of hands, how many people here are, you know, doing a fair amount of MVC already? Okay, I would expect to see most hands go up to that, cool. So attribute routing kind of changes things. You should be familiar, based on those hands, you should be familiar with the centralized routing that's been there since the start of MVC, where you declare your routes and you've got route templates and stuff. But as many of you have probably experienced, when you start getting into a big complex site with lots of different pages, and especially when you want to have explicit control over the URL space of the way users get to your different pages, it can get a little cumbersome working with it in that centralized fashion. So attribute routing gives you a way to declaratively, at a individual action level on a controller, be able to say, this is the route that gets me to this method, right there while you're working on it and thinking about that controller and that action, not having to go out and look at a whole pile of routes in your route configuration centrally and try to figure out which one of those is gonna get me to this particular page or controller action. So we'll take a look at that. Owen and Katana, hopefully you have heard those acronym plus name somewhere by this point. They are the underpinnings of all the new information that's been released this week about the what's being called ASP.NET VNext, the componentization of the whole HTTP request processing stack. So if you went to the keynote, you saw some of that, and if you went to any of the other web talks, you saw a lot of information about this new ASP.NET VNX. Owen Katana is already there in the projects you're already doing if you're using MVC 5 and Visual Studio 2013. So we'll talk a little bit about what it is and show where it shows up in your MVC projects. Then we'll touch on ASP.NET Identity. I'm not going to go real deep here because there's a whole session dedicated to this tomorrow at 10:15 with Ida Flatow over in the Hilton Ballroom, so I'd encourage you to check that out. But we'll touch on the core fundamentals there in case you can't make that session. We're also going to touch on SignalR, which is kind of a totally separate part of the ASP.NET stack from MVC. But more and more, you know, any web developer these days is probably getting some pressure to have their pages be more interactive, more kind of long-running, interactive, stateful communications with the user without having to do full postbacks. And part of that model is also being able to make modifications to that change when things change on the back end. So SignalR is a great technology for that. If anyone's been exposed to WCF callbacks, you can certainly make analogies there. So we'll take a brief look at that as well, because it is a great feature to integrate into your MVC sites, especially if you have those more kind of long-running pages that the user works with for a while, more leaning into the direction of single-page applications. And then we'll finish off, as time allows, with a few scattered editor features. There's new features for HTML editing, SAS editing, JSON editing, and stuff like that, and TypeScript released with the update 2 that just RTM'd here at TechEd. So that's the game plan. Let's just start stepping through it here. So ASP.NET, one ASP.NET is the buzz phrase here. And really what it boils down to, you know, you can use it as kind of an overarching philosophy for ASP.NET, and it's part of the idea behind this session, is that you can't really be a siloed MVC developer anymore or just a web forms developer. You're really an ASP.NET developer, and there's lots of different features in the ASP.NET stack that to build a rich, you know, fully featured web application these days, you need to be taking advantage of multiple vertical slices or stacks, if you will, within the ASP.NET arena. So as an overarching philosophy, that's kind of what one ASP.NET means, but at a more fundamental level, what it means to you is every time you go to start a new project in Visual Studio 2013, you're going to have a new startup experience for that project. So we're just going to dive right in there. You'll see that basically instead of having to choose up front between I'm doing MVC 4, or I'm doing web forms, or I'm doing an empty thing and going to cobble it together myself, you start off with kind of a one project type, but then you add a la carte items into that. And you get to pick right up front what's your security model. That's not baked into the template that you pick like it was in 2012. And a new feature that came in with update 2 is the ability to provision and tie your web project directly into an Azure website or virtual machine as part of that process. You certainly don't have to do it then. It's not hard to add it in later, but it just gives you an upfront starting point to just tie it right in right away and be able to publish and even do remote debugging against the cloud. Once you get past that initial point, you know, you're not done with the one ASP.NET experience. They've done a lot of improvements to the add new item templates and the scaffolding that you can use to generate new items within the project, and we'll see a few of those. So with that, let me switch over to my demo machine here, and we will fire up Visual Studio. And this starting point, of course, is as soon as you say new project and go into the ASP.NET arena, you've got the, you know, just one simple project type there. You don't have to pick from a bunch of different ones that have things hard-coded into them. In case you're, you know, more familiar with those and you want to stick with those models, they're still there under the 2012 subnode here, and you can pick from those. But basically, this is a better starting point for you. So we'll just call this web demo. And say OK here. And this is where you really start getting to choose. But now it's much more like ordering off a menu instead of having things hard-baked into those templates. So let me explain some of the differences here, because people often get confused because you think you're going to end up the same place from different selections, but you're not. So if you're doing core MVC development, you're going to build a web page-oriented site, and MVC is going to be your primary technology for building out that application, then definitely picking the MVC template here is a good starting point. This is going to give you much like what you had with MVC 4 projects in 2012. It's going to give you your home about contacts page. It's going to give you the shared layout page. It's going to tie in bundling and minification. It's going to have all that standard structure you should be used to if you're an MVC 4 developer. Now, if you look over here, you've got an option to say empty and then check MVC down at the bottom. So what's the difference between those two options? Well, as the top level option implies, this is still an empty website. So you don't have a layout page. You don't have a home page or an about page or a contacts page. You don't have bundling and minification wired up. All you really have is the right references there to start doing MVC. Now, it's fairly easy with the item templates to then start going right-click, add new item, MVC controller, and then right-click and generate your pages the way MVC has always supported. But you lose some of that initial setup of the surrounding infrastructure of the layout page and the bundling and minification that you probably don't want to have to set up all by yourself. So anytime I'm intending to put one or more MVC pages into a site, I'm going to start with the MVC top-level template so that I get that right structure in my surrounding site. Now, conversely, in case you're doing web API stuff, there's a number of great talks on that here at the conference, and you certainly might be doing web API as part of your MVC site. So it may be first and foremost a page-oriented site that you're developing, but some of those pages may have some AJAX going on, and the best way to back your AJAX calls these days when you're doing ASP.NET already is to use ASP.NET Web API. So you could select the Web API project here, and some people get a little confused because down here both MVC and Web API are checked, and you don't have the option to turn them off. What they actually generate there is a little bit different. It's supposed to be primarily a web API site, but they want you to at least have a kind of landing home welcome page just so it's not a completely empty site on you. So they put a basic page and layout and stuff in there, but it's not as fully fleshed out as an MVC site. So if you're really doing just web API, which is not unusual these days, if you're just going to have mobile clients out there or desktop clients calling into your web APIs, then a better starting point is actually empty plus web API, because then you really just start with a clean slate. The only thing that's wired up in it is the routing scheme to be able to start doing web APIs. Okay, once you get past all that, so we're going to go with the MVC template here, and I'll go ahead and check the block for web API just so we can see what else that adds for us. Unit tests, that's been there all along, still recommended, won't go into details there. I'll leave it unchecked, which most people will say check it by default. That really depends on your perspective. Some people prefer other frameworks for unit testing other than Visual Studio. I happen to use Visual Studio myself mostly, but there's opinions on that. Let's just leave it at that. And so, yes, do unit testing, absolutely. What framework you choose for that is completely up to you. In the upper right corner, now you've got another a la carte menu to pick your authentication. So as opposed to the MVC4 templates or web form templates, having a particular kind of security baked in that sometimes, especially as you were getting started, trying to find all the bits and pieces it had in there and trying to figure out how to switch it over to a different kind of authentication was a fair amount of work. Here you get to pick up front. So hopefully you at least know as you're setting out to build your new project or get started with it for production, what kind of security model you're going to have. None should be obvious. At the bottom, Windows authentication should be obvious. Same kind of Windows auth we've had since the dawn of time with NTLM or Kerberos tied in, basically for behind the firewall kind of Windows authentication. The two main choices that have new variants to them is individual user accounts, yet another name for forms authentication. At the end of the day, it's still a cookie-based authentication, set up a secure session after validating some credentials somewhere, and just round trip that cookie to keep the secure session alive. But what's different about it is, first off, the underpinnings of what gets generated is part of the ASP.NET identity stuff we'll touch on later. And also, you can see up in the text here, it talks about Twitter, Google, Facebook. So being able to do OAuth2-based identity providers, let the authentication happen on their site through using their username and password with that provider, and then just bring back an OAuth token that your site is validating and associating with the provider. And then organizational accounts is an option there to be able to use more kind of federated Active Directory-based stuff, either your own Active Directory on-premise, cloud-based Active Directory with Azure Active Directory, or a organizational account like Office 365. So I'm going to stick to the default here of individual user accounts so that we can look at some of what that generates for us. And then the new kid on the block here, again, comes in with the update 2 changes. is that now you can do this provisioning of the Windows Azure stuff. And so you could check the block here and say, eventually, I'm going to host in the cloud. This does not mean that as soon as you start debugging, you're working in the cloud. You're still working totally locally. You're, you know, working against ASP.NET on your local machine, localhost, IIS Express, all the stuff you should be used to as web developers. It just means that at the point where you want to start testing it and trying it out in a cloud, maybe from multiple clients across the network and on different networks, all you got to do is publish, and it's right there, and it's ready and provisioned for you. And if you've seen in some of the other demos, some of the new features include the ability to remote debug against those Azure websites, as well as the other option here, which is a virtual machine. Now, a question that often comes up when people see this is to say, well, what about cloud services or web roles, if you are familiar with that term? That was actually the first way we had with Azure of getting our websites out into the cloud. It's still there. It's still completely viable. It still has certain edge case scenarios that it supports that Azure websites do not. And so, you know, some people would look at this and wonder why it's not there. You know, they're not sure yet if they're going to add it or not. It kind of depends on the demand for it. To a certain degree, they keep adding and adding and adding new features to Azure websites to the point where, like I said, it's really a marginal difference of really niche features that would make you want to do a cloud service instead of a website. Azure websites are super easy to set up, super easy to maintain. We've got remote debugging against them and lots of features like that. SSL certificates, highly scalable, all that kind of stuff applies. So there's very few scenarios where you might actually choose from scratch to use a cloud service these days. So at this point, it's not one of the options here. Maybe it'll be there in the future. It really depends on demand from the community. Now, I'm not going to bother with that right now because then you got to go sign in. You pick a website name. It pre-provisions that stuff, and it basically puts some PowerShell script stuff in your solution to be able to publish and republish and so on. Not part of the demo I'm going to do here. Okay, so we'll go ahead and let it generate our site there. And it's basically, you know, pulling down the appropriate NuGets here and generating some pages. Should be fairly quick here. And then we end up with our site here. Now, some of the things that, you know, kind of fold into this whole one ASP.NET arena is if I want to go out and, you know, do something more than the hello type pages that they're doing, I'm going to go pull in a separate project I have here for some data access. So let me drop out to my demos here, go to this ZA data layer and add a reference to it. So this is basically just a entity framework, DB context-based, code-first data access layer that works against some data that's pizza-related, pizza ordering scenario is what we've got there. And let me just go grab a connection string real quick, put that in my web config. So let's go find my web config up here, collapse things down, and pop a connection string in here. Okay, now what that lets me do, now some of this is stuff that was pre-existing. If you've been doing MVC 4 for long, you probably used some of this stuff, but some of this is new I want to show, is that now I could go and do something like add a new controller. And you can see we've got a bunch of different templates in there, a lot of which are new, just based on version, so they're MVC 5 versus 4. You've got 3-4 MVC-oriented stuff. You've got 3-4 normal Web API-type stuff, and then you've got two more for Web API OData-type stuff. The one I'm going to be using here is the one with Entity Framework, since that's what my model is. And my Add button's off-screen and hopefully is the default there. So very similar to the dialogue that was there before, since MVC4, that we're going to go and we'll use the customer from my ZADB context. Async controller actions, that's been around since MVC4. A lot of people maybe haven't used them a whole lot because unless you actually had an async call chain all the way down to some external service call or a call out to the database that was somehow async, even though Entity Framework didn't support it, it didn't buy you a whole lot. Now, one of the things that came in with MVC5 is Entity Framework 6. And one of the features there are async methods on your DB context. So we can check this block now, and when it scaffolds things out for us. Ooh, no, don't do that to me. Well, worst case, I've got one that's already been generated. Let me build real quick and see if that makes it happy. I think I'm probably missing some NuGets. Try it one more time. Save one. Customer. add. Okay, that looks like it's going better. So the main thing I want to show here is it's very similar to what has been generated in the past with MVC 4, but notice the, and I forgot to check the async. Darn it. Okay, we'll do it with a different entity this time. Let's go with add controller, MVC 5. We'll do product this time, and I'll remember to check this block. Okay, so the key thing I want to show here is that when it generates the data access against the DB context now, it leverages the fact that notice to list async, find async. Somewhere down below, there's a save changes async. So your entity framework DB context now have those task-based asynchronous methods that you can do an await on, wrap it in a task-based method, and your controller actions can return tasks. Now, what does that buy you in the end? Well, if you have that end-to-end call chain where the request comes in on the front end, you're tying up a thread to process that request up until the point where you go and block for some database access if you're not doing it async. That database access finally completes, you come back, you generate a response that goes out the door, and you're tying up one of your request processing threads that whole time. If you set up an end-to-end async call chain like this, now basically it's tying up that thread as long as it takes to dispatch the tasks, but then it frees up that request processing thread until the async completion occurs. So it basically makes you more scalable. Now, there are caveats to this. This is not the best thing to do in all given scenarios. If you've got a single backend database and it's always going to be the hotspot, and you know, lots of caveats there, there can be situations where this might actually hurt you just a tiny bit. There is overhead in doing tasks and doing this asynchronous dispatch of the calls, small, tiny amount of memory overhead and processor overhead to do the dispatching. Generally, you're going to benefit from this in the big scheme of things in terms of scale, but it's something you'll want to do some decent profiling on once you get close to production to see if it's helping you out. But the key thing here is now all the way to the database where we get that blocking I/O, we can just dispatch it as a chain of tasks that then free up that thread immediately, and your request processing thread can go and answer another call from another user. Okay, and with that in place, I can also run here and just show you some of the stuff we'll be leading into here with Bootstrap. So when we first start up the site here, ever so slowly, we see the basic styling here, and a lot of the styling and stuff you're seeing here is being done with Bootstrap, and we'll dive into that a little bit more in just a bit. But if I go out to my products controller I just generated and hit that, cross my fingers, okay, we see some nice tabular presentation, and again, it's nice and pretty and clean. This isn't a data grid controller or anything. It's just TDs and TRs, but it's being styled by Bootstrap as part of that integration. And one other new feature in Update 2 that is or should be highlighted here, if I got my customers one, let me actually try that again. Start it up, go to customers, and actually, no, let me change one line of code before I start it up. So there's a trick I'm having to play here is that on my customer object, I've got an enum property, and the enum, my database is not set up for that enum. So I basically, how many times am I going to do that? Stop debugging. Basically, what I want to do is tell it to ignore from a data access perspective that single property that's based on an enum. But if I do that before I do the code generation with MVC, it's just going to ignore that for the scaffolding as well. So I had that commented out for the scaffolding, but now at runtime, I need to tell it to ignore that or it'll throw database errors. And so I should be able to go to customers and get our list, and then go to edit. And what you'll see down here is the scaffolding can now generate based on an enum property. It can generate a drop-down list for you. So there's a new HTML helper there. If we look at the code, back up here in our views, customers, we'll go to edit and kind of scroll down here. You'll see down at the bottom this, where is it? Oh, that's index, sorry. Edit. And you see this enum dropdown list 4. So you can just point to an enum property. It'll reflect on that, find the different values it can take on, and it'll generate a dropdown list for you, which is kind of nice. Okay, so that's just an example of some of these new one ASP.NET features. and what the experience of using them are. Now, let me jump back over to the slides for a moment. Next thing I wanted to touch on here is browser link. And as I said, a lot of you have probably seen this in demos, but I just want to make sure everyone gets exposed here. Very nice feature that basically gives you this bidirectional connection between Visual Studio and one or more instances of browsers that you might be debugging in. You can basically make edits in the Visual Studio code, hit a refresh button, and all the browsers that are connected will refresh and show you that. And the new thing with Update 2 and the Web Essentials Toolkit is that you can also now make the changes on the client side. So if you're used to debugging with the browser development tools, whether in Chrome or Internet Explorer, F12, to get to the development tools, you go in there and you start tweaking code in there, it's actually going to synchronize those changes back to your code in Visual Studio. And we'll see that here in a moment. So especially when you get down to that point where you're just tweaking a page, you're trying to get the styling right, you're maybe changing some of the static text on there, changing some backgrounds and things like that, column sizes with Bootstrap. It's a very handy feature to be able to work in the context that you're seeing in the browser and make those modifications and have those changes synchronized immediately down to Visual Studio and back up to all the other browser instances you're connected to. So let's jump over here and go back to running this thing, and we'll see this in action. Okay, so I'm gonna kind of rearrange things here. We don't want to be there. We'll go to the root here. Okay, so we're on our homepage. Let me slap this over to the side, get Visual Studio over here, kind of rearrange some space so you can kind of see what's going on in Visual Studio. And so the basic browser link experience is that I could go find something like my home index page that we're on, and find some of this top-level text we're looking at, just go add some text in there and find this little browser link button up here, and you can see right away one browser connected. And before I even push that change, let me fire up another instance of IE in this case. As soon as I hit that page and go back to Visual Studio, go back to my button, now two browsers connected, and it lists what those are. So if I refresh, let me bring Chrome back up so we can see it, you know, real time here. Hit the button over on the right, you see the spinny at the top, and now that change is visible on that one, as well as back over here on the IE instance. So obviously it doesn't play real well on a, you know, single screen, low resolution like this, but get it out on a multi-monitor developer workstation with different browser instances, and you can tweak here and see it there, there, and there, tweak it there, see it there, there, there. You know, it basically puts this whole synchronized arena between all your debugging instances, whether you're making the changes server-side or client-side. The client-side experience, I'll just minimize this guy and stick to Chrome for now, is that now, and again, you need the Web Essentials Toolkit to light this part up. Make sure it's the one that's for Update 2. I believe the one that's currently out there on NuGet still says release candidate on it. I'm sure that'll be updated within a day or two here, but it works fine here with the release version of Update 2. And so what you can do is over here in the browser, I can just hit the Control key. And if you look down here at the bottom of the browser, this little semi-transparent toolbar pops up. And we have a couple of options here. One is I can go into inspect mode here and look at Visual Studio as I'm moving my mouse over different segments of the text here in the browser. It's jumping around, finding where that is in my source code and highlighting that. So it makes it very nice in inspect mode when you've got all this stuff on the page and you're like, I need to go edit this, but I don't know where the heck that lives in my solution. You don't want to go hunting around for it. Just go into inspect mode, you know, find that thing, get it highlighted there, and then you can go do your edits over here if that's where you prefer to do your editing. But the other thing you can do, thank you. I don't get to claim credit for that. I'm just the demo monkey. The other thing you can do, though, is go into design mode here. You click on this, and you can go up here, and things become editable. So we can go correct our, you know, typing up there, right into, oh, that wasn't what I meant to do. Okay, that would be demo monkeying for sure. Let's try that again. Control, design mode. Okay, there seems to be in highlight mode, and now we can make that edit, and notice over here on the left, those changes immediately synchronize down to Visual Studio. And when you refresh over here in Visual Studio, it would push back out to the other browsers. The other key thing is remember to save your changes, because it's really just changing the text in memory in your editors there. But that gives you the chance to just tweak things on the client side, have the changes in your source code already in Visual Studio. Just go save those changes, check it in, and you're ready to go. And it lets you use those, you know, and if you want to go into the F12 debugging experience in IE or Chrome here and go change styles and things like that, those things will be synchronized down as well. So much richer experience there. And there's one other place you can go to do this stuff is up here. You can see there's this browser link dashboard that's in Visual Studio itself. It lists out all the connections you have. And then for a given connection, you can drop down and kick it into inspect mode. Again, doesn't work real well here with the screen real estate, but you can see it's back in that mode where it's following my mouse, basically. So very nice feature there with Browser Link for in that, you know, kind of tweak and fine-tune stage of your development process. All right. Yes. Yeah, so it figures out things like partials. You know, it's basically it's MVC aware. So it's able to jump down into partials. It's able to jump to places in your layout view. It'll find the right place in your MVC structure. Now, if you have something like a, you know, very opaque HTML helper, some third-party libraries, for example, you may have one line of HTML helper code for generating a whole data grid. It's not going to be able to, you know, go any further than locate the element or the HTML helper that's generating that stuff. You know, if you're highlighting on different rows, you're not going to see anything change, and it'll just be sitting there on the HTML helper that generated it all. But it does an amazing job of sorting that stuff out. I'm not sure how it does it all. Okay, so that's Browser Link. How are we doing on time? Cool. Next thing here is Bootstrap. So as I mentioned, you know, so high level, what is Bootstrap? If you haven't been exposed, it's a responsive design framework. What's responsive design? It's generally the idea that I want to write one set of HTML and CSS and probably some supporting JavaScript, and I want it to look right, whether I'm on a big desktop browser, whether I'm on a tablet browser in portrait or landscape, or I'm on a phone and looking at that same page in the browser. And I don't want to have a bunch of conditional, you know, checking user agent strings and using different markup for the different sizes and stuff. So Bootstrap is one. There's other frameworks out there like this. Foundation is another popular one. But the idea is there's a whole slew of classes defined that some of which just apply to elements by default. So, you know, some of that fonts and things we saw in the default web page there are just simply there by pulling in the CSS file for Bootstrap. And so you get, you know, rounded corners on buttons, and you get nice fonts and things like that just right off the bat. And then being able to go in and in a very fine-grained way, just apply classes to things to get things like table striping I'll show and have those horizontal rule lines when we saw the table rendering of our customers and products. That stuff all just comes kind of for free, where free means put a class on an element and you get some nice, decent styling. If you don't like the default styling is by design very simplistic. There are whole themes out there you can buy that are Bootstrap-based. You just bring those in, and they replace all the default stylings, and you light up, you know, maybe a Metro theme with square corners instead of default rounded corners with Bootstrap. So you could do this stuff even before MVC. It's really just a JavaScript library for widgets and a CSS file for the styling. You could pull those in manually from GitHub or just pull it down as a NuGet integrated into your application yourself. But what they did here is just made it, you know, a little bit easier to get started. So it's part of your MVC project from the get-go, and they've also got some of those classes already wired up for you in the stuff that they scaffold out for you. So what that looks like in more detail here, if we go back to our demo, let me fire it up again. I'm sorry, I can barely hear you. Could you yell that or hit the mic there since you're close?
So is it tied into the public NuGet packages? So if they update their NuGet package?
Yes, great question. So really, you know, when it comes right down to it, what are they doing for you here? One, they're just taking a dependency on the public NuGet package for Bootstrap, and we can see that here. If we go into our solution and just go to manage our NuGets, which we can't get to because we're running. Stop running for a moment. go to our managed NuGets, to our install package, and you can see the bootstrap there. So yes, you know, as new releases come out, you can choose to update. Just go to the update section of your NuGet thing here. It'll tell you if there's a new one and you can choose to update it. You gotta be a little careful with that, you know, because there are interdependencies. If you have, for example, if you're doing some single page app stuff with Angular Bootstrap, which is a separate library that wraps some of the Bootstrap widgets with Angular directives, then you gotta make sure you have version compatibilities there between the dependencies. Usually NuGet does a good job of that for you. Sometimes when you have major releases, there were certain pain points, especially when Web API 2 came out and you had, you know, lots of complex dependencies there. Just doing an update all was a good way to break your application. So you gotta be a little careful with that, make sure you're all checked in and stable before you start trying to apply those updates. But yes, the Bootstrap is really just being added by default as one of the default NuGet packages of the solution. Okay, so let me run this and, you know, show visually what is Bootstrap doing. Like I said, the fonts and some of the things, like the big gray area up here is a class called a Jumbotron. You can put multiple images and some text in there and sequence between them, you know, kind of standard scroller marquee type stuff at the top. Just little things like your buttons here, you know, so you get nice rounded corners and blue backgrounds and good mouse over effects and stuff instead of the plain boring default button of HTML. But you get that stuff just by putting a single class on there, a BTN. And then really where the responsive part of this comes in is notice that, like, down here, we've got these three side-by-side sections of our page. As we come out of full screen here, let me just expand back out, you can see first thing that happens, also notice at the top, we start with a nice menu bar that's got mouse over effects and stuff. As we start crunching down our screen, when it gets to a certain point, you saw the content down at the bottom jumps, and now it's vertically aligned and scroll vertically. So as you get on, say, a portrait tablet, you don't have the real estate to have all those side by side. It'll just jump things and make them scroll for you and give a nice experience there. But we've still got the menu bar at the top. And then we crunch it down, whoops. Then we crunch it down some more, and watch in the upper right, notice the menus went away and we get the little hamburger icon with a flyout menu. And all you have to do is apply a couple of classes to get this stuff to happen. It just, what it's got under the cover are CSS media queries with some predefined limits that it's looking at for basically four sizes that Bootstrap supports right now out of the box. They're called extra small, medium, large, and extra large, I believe, are the monikers for them. But it basically equates to, you know, a desktop browser, a landscape tablet browser, a portrait tablet browser, and a phone is what they roughly equate to in terms of current device resolutions. And you can have really fine-grained control with the classes where you can set different column widths and stuff with their grid layout system to say, you know, if I'm on this device, I want it 3x3, but if I go down to this size, then I'd want to put them all vertically, or maybe go 1x2 by, you know, whatever kind of layout you want, triggered by these different default sizes. So that's really the responsive layout part of what Bootstrap does for you. You know, in terms of what MVC is doing for you to give it to you, first off, when you create your project, as I mentioned, down here in your shared layout page, you've always got, up at the top, you've got this content CSS bundle that's being pulled in. And if you go look at the bundle definition in your app start, you can see that now Bootstrap is being pulled in as part of that bundle explicitly. So Bootstrap is basically there for you at your top level layout page, cascading down to your content pages that live within it. And so just that's where the styles and some of that stuff comes in automatically. And then in the pages that they're generating for you, whether they're generated at the start, like your home pages with the index page here, you can see some stuff like class row, class column, medium four, class button, button default down here. So the way Bootstrap works is it has these fine-grained classes that say, okay, first and foremost, I'm a button. Bam, you now have rounded corners, and you have a certain font applied to you, a certain background. And then you can say btn-primary, and you get a blue button. btn-default, you get a gray button. And they have these, you know, very fine-grained classes that are additive so that you can just say, I want this, and this, and this, and this applied to me as a button, and just tack those things on. So for example, if I run and go to my customers again, just go customers up here and let that load up. You saw that what we got is a nice looking table. We've got these horizontal rules And all that's being applied here by default is in the code. We've got a TBL, or a table, I'm sorry, a class applied to our customer's root table. So we go into index, and we see here class equals table. And we get all that nice styling, margins on each column so they're not right up against each other like they would be in raw HTML, just by applying that one class. Well, maybe I want to have alternating rows. How hard is that? I just say table-stripe. Notice also the IntelliSense here. That's part of the new editor features. You're getting IntelliSense for third-party libraries such as Bootstrap, Angular, Knockout. You're going to get a good IntelliSense experience against their exposed APIs, whether it's CSS or JavaScript-based. So just with that one change, we could fire this thing up again and get to our customer's index. That'll work. And now we should see alternating gray rows, basically, once it renders out there. So you can see the default scaffolded pages already have kind of a minimalistic application of the Bootstrap classes to give a good look and feel. But then you can go in and just tweak those by adding or modifying the classes that are applied. And that's basically all there is to Bootstrap. There is more to it in the sense that Bootstrap also has a script file. So you can see a Bootstrap.js here. That's basically a set of predefined widgets for things like being able to have a scrolling Jumbotron kind of thing, being able to have a pager if you're doing paging within a table. So you render things out with a nicely formatted table, and then you put a pager control to sequence between pages. They don't say, you know, how do you wire up the logic of what happens when they click on it, but they give you a nice rendered control that you can easily wire up yourself with events. There's other things like a modal dialog and things like that that are common requirements, just a set of maybe a dozen or so widgets that are part of the Bootstrap library. Okay, so let's switch back over here. And that's Bootstrap in a nutshell. Next thing is attribute routing. And this one, again, is very simple in concept, very simple to apply, but it has a lot of benefits as you get into bigger and more complex web applications. So as I talked about in the intro there, you should be used to as MVC developers going into your route config and defining route templates. The default one covers a wide spectrum of things, being based on the controller name, based on the action that you want to call in that controller. You can use MVC areas to partition your website into kind of subdirectories and have that as part of your routing scheme. But when you get into more complicated things, especially if you want to have kind of fine-grained control, as I mentioned before, of your URL space, maybe you want to have a particular sub route or URL for some feature set of your application, and it may not be organized one-for-one with the way you want the URL space to reflect. Then the built-in routing, the centralized routing, starts to break down for you. So what this lets you do is on a per-action method basis, put an attribute on it and say, this is the route that gets me here. And there's no question of looking at the method and going, I wonder which one of those 10 routes in my route config applies to this, and having to try and have conflicts and stuff like that. So again, easy to apply. If we go back out here to one of our controllers, we could drop down to, let's just do it in our simple home controllers here. We'll go to the controllers, not the pages. Go to our home controller. We'll drop down here to the contact one. We'll say, I just really, for whatever reason, wanted my users to see this address as foobarbaz. That's the way they get to the contact page. And just by putting the attribute on the method like that, we should be able to fire up. We can still get to /home/index and the other actions on that same controller, if I could spell it, same way they always did. But then if we go to /foo/bar/paz, we should get the contact page, or not. Because important step I forgot. I always do this. I do a lot of web API. When you pull web API in, you'll see that the web API default config has this magic line of code that says map HTTP attribute routes. So they do it by default on the web API side. For whatever reason, in the default route config for MVC, they don't, so you have to remember to drop in here, stop debugging, and say routes.map MVC attribute routes. So there's, you know, complex reasons behind the scenes that the routing stuff for Web API and MVC are separate at the current time, and things like action filterings a little bit different, and so on. Those are some of those things that the ASP.NET VNext is also going to fix, because you basically will have a unified stack now for MVC, web forms, web API, and things like action filters and routing and attributes and stuff like that. You'll just have one that applies to all of ASP.NET. For the current time, you do still have kind of a divided world there. The things look very similar, as you can see, but there is kind of a different system in place for your MVC pages and your web API controllers. So with that in place, I should be able to do the foobar-baz thing. And you do have to make sure that that is called before your other routes. So that it basically is going out, it's reflecting on your WebAssembly, it's looking for those route attributes, and it's putting those first in the route table, and then it's populating the ones that are based on your route template after that. So foobar-baz. And there's our contact page. Okay. So make sure you remember this, as I always forget it myself. Got to get that in there so that it actually goes looking for them. But from there, you just go to your controller methods where you want to do this, wherever that was, our home controller, and say route and whatever route segment you want. These can have placeholders, just like the default ones can. So if you wanted to, instead of naming your IDs ID, if you wanted to say, I want a, you know, customer ID here as the name of my parameter, and then declare it as maybe int customer ID, then you can go ahead and do that. It will be a case-sensitive match, so you can have those same kind of curly brace placeholders in your routes that you define at the method level, and you can even have multiples of those, you know, slash this, slash the other, slash that. They'll all come in as name parameters into the method. Okay. So that is attribute routing. Any questions on that? All right. Next thing is Owen Katana. And so, as I mentioned, hopefully you've at least heard these names before with all the new announcements around the ASP.NET VNext. Owen stands for Open Web Interface for .NET. It's really kind of an open platform definition, very simple in nature, that basically says, what does it look like in the simplest possible form to define what it looks like to handle a request and produce a response? And not tied to any platform specifics, not tied to anything, basically comes down to give me a request, I'll produce a response, and also give me some kind of dictionary that gives me sort of configuration parameters about the environment I'm working in, and not even tie that dictionary to something like HTTP context that makes presumptions about your hosting environment. So that's what Owen is at a high level. Katana is basically an implementation of that open interface for the .NET platform, for ASP.NET and IIS and system.web currently. So as I mentioned, this is kind of a precursor to the ASP.NET VNext stuff. And basically, it's already integrated into some stuff. So for the MVC pages you'll be writing, it's not really directly involved in the rendering of those MVC pages yet. As part of the ASP.NET VNext stuff, it will be. But what it is already being used for under the covers is Web API controllers and your service methods you expose from those, SignalR, which I'll be showing, and the ASP.NET identity system that I'll be showing. So those are all already using Owen Katana, even in the current bits with MVC 5. So the pages are not being rendered specifically on top of Owen Katana, but if the request is coming in and is authenticated with ASP.NET identity, it first passes through your Owen Katana stuff to get authenticated and then gets dispatched on to the MVC controller. So in a nutshell, Owen Katana is middleware. It's about having this kind of layered architecture that says, I can just plug in new things in the pipeline, much like we did in the past with modules and HTTP handlers. You can think of it as kind of replacing that infrastructure as the request processing pipeline with this other kind of granular component that's more platform agnostic. So Web API, SignalR, ASP.NET Identity already using these. In the future, pretty much all of ASP.NET will be based on this with ASP.NET VNext. But it's actually a replacement for the current implementation of Owen. So you'll see things out there in some of the blog posts and stuff where it'll mention the Owen DLL being deprecated. In the context of ASP.NET VNext it is, which seems a little weird to people because they're like, wait, this is brand new stuff to me and it's already deprecated. Cool, I like this new agile environment. So let's take a look at what this looks like in terms of the code you'll be experiencing with MVC 5. Now, part of the, because I selected the individual user accounts, let me just start up the site here so I can point to, in the upper right corner, much like you're used to in prior versions of MVC, we can see the register and log on. We can go and register a new account. We can get a log on dialog and so on. And that's tied in now with the ASP.NET identity. The ASP.NET identity, which I haven't covered yet, but just to show you, you know, it actually ties in this concept of Owen Katana. If I get inside the site, you'll see this thing called a startup class. So anytime you see iApp Builder in sample code and stuff, you're looking at Owen Katana stuff. Basically, it's this idea that you'll have a chain, a composition chain, where a chunk of code like the startup code configure gets called and gets passed an app builder. And it can use that app builder to tie in its middleware to the request processing pipeline, and then it should invoke the next component down the chain. What this is actually doing, you can see here, is calling a configure auth. And there is a convention to this that the name of startup here, you can see there's an assembly level attribute wired in here that points to this class. And by convention, it's expecting a configuration method that takes an IAP builder. This is another one of those things. If you saw some of the code about ASP.NET vNext, that's changing slightly. If you see iBuilder instead of IAP builder, it's the same exact concept. It's just the ASP.NET vNext version of it. There's some subtle aspect about app builder that's a little too .NET specific for the Owen guys. So they're doing it in a more platform agnostic way with iBuilder in vNext. But this basically starts tying in some middleware to the request processing pipeline. And I'll get to the you know, what it does under the covers, because it's ASP.NET related. Now, on web APIs, if you add a web API, you're going to see a similar thing. You'll see a startup class, and you'll see a configure with a app.something that ties in ASP.NET web API, and it basically ties in the web API processing pipeline and the routing and so on. And if you tie in SignalR, you'll see another app.something for SignalR, and we'll see that in a later demo. So you'll see these chunks of code coming in that are Owen-based or Katana-based that have this app.something in a startup file, and that's how it's tying in different processing pipelines using the Owen infrastructure. So let me switch back real quick and talk about the security bits before we dig down into those. ASP.NET identity, what is it? Well, Microsoft's really good about getting things right on version 3, right? So let's hope that that holds true here as well. From a cynical perspective, you can look at this as version 3 of ASP.NET identity. First, we had, you know, really in ASP.NET 2.0, we had membership and role providers come in. And those things were great, been using them for years, never had any problems with them myself, really. But specifically, the one thing a lot of people didn't like about the membership and role providers was the fact that especially to do your own custom providers, you had to implement this big old class with 20-some methods, most of which were about provisioning and managing your identities and roles. And then there was one or a few methods that you cared about for the runtime aspects. So it wasn't, you know, good from an interface segregation principle of the solid principles that you really had two separate concerns all glommed onto one class. You had to at least have kind of stubbed out implementations of everything to do anything custom. That's one of the complaints. The other was certainly with the earlier stuff, as stuff like OAuth became popular, it didn't have direct support for that. So then we got simple membership, which came in with MVC 4 as kind of V2, which supposedly simplified some things, but it didn't quite go far enough for some people. It did do the separation. It did give you support for OAuth, but there were still a lot of things people didn't like about that. So ASP.NET identity is kind of take three, just another attempt at getting the, you know, the structure of the code and the way you go about doing it as easy as to use as possible, to have the right separation and to have full support for those new forms of authentication that are becoming popular. As I mentioned, this is built on as a chunk of Owen middleware that plugs in through that code we were just looking at. Technically, if you look at the partitioning of the code, ASP.NET identity itself is really just about the management of the information, creating users, setting passwords, resetting passwords, provisioning stuff, basically. And then it's Owen Katana middleware that does the authentication. But you'll see these all kind of lumped into ASP.NET identity, treating that as a bubble that says that's the ASP.NET security system, which includes both the Owen authentication piece and the technically the ASP.NET identity libraries that do the provisioning type stuff. Part of this is it's all an interface-based API so that you can provide your own implementations as custom. But to make that as easy as possible, they also give you some entity framework DB context-based infrastructure for storing it in SQL Server if you're doing true custom usernames and passwords and that kind of stuff. So let's take a look at what this code looks like. Back to where we were with this, you know, hookup of some basic O and Katana stuff and this call to configure auth. So if you look here, this is a partial class called startup. And what they actually do is put the other part of the partial class up here in your app start directory. And this is where that configure auth method lives. Now, I'm not going to go into all the gory details of what it's doing here. I just want to give you a general sense. And like I said, if you want the in-depth dive, go to Ida's talk tomorrow at 10:15. That's going to be all about ASP.NET identity and the security system. But you can see you basically get passed in this app, and then eventually you start calling app.something. And so the basic API of these Owen-based things is to use extension methods off the IAP builder interface to make it so you can kind of put together a fluent API that just says app.... if you want to, although you'll usually break it out in separate lines of code like this. And so it's basically configuring some stuff. What it's doing here is saying, okay, I want to set up my default DB context that knows how to go read and write my usernames and passwords and that kind of stuff. And then I want to associate it with something called a user manager. So there's a user manager of T base class that sets up. The T will be your model object, basically, that represents a user. It, by default, it's got your basic username password type stuff, but then you can put custom properties on it for profile type information if you like. And then you have a user manager that that wraps that. And what it's using by default is that application DB context, which is just a custom DB context that, you know, already has the API defined for standard operations to do with managing users' roles. And also the other thing to emphasize here, with the newer forms of ASP.NET security, you know, it brings to the surface the fact that all of your security in .NET, if you're not aware of it, since .NET 4.5 is now all claims-based. So you probably heard the term claims-based authentication and claims-based authorization. Really, claims-based authentication is a misnomer, but claims-based authorization, and you know, some of you may even be using that explicitly. But if you don't know, in .NET 4.5, they changed out the base classes of the principal implementations, even generic principal, and it derives from a claims principle. So you can be doing more fine-grained permission checking, basically. Instead of having to think of things in terms of roles, you can think of things in terms of, you know, does this user have the right to edit this field, you know, this column in this collection of data, and get as fine-grained as you want to be like that. So some of that stuff becomes more, you know, to the foreground in the new identity system as well. But bottom line, what all this code is doing is it's going and it's configuring some Owen setup. You know, what's my DB context? What's my user manager that's going to be consulted whenever I'm provisioning things? And gets that all configured so that every time a request comes in, this stuff's going to be invoked. And then down at the bottom here, they kind of stub out the code. If you do want to do OAuth providers, other identity providers, each one of those, if you've never gone through it, you basically have to go out to their site, to some kind of developer site, provision your app as a known application to them, and they'll give you back usually two pieces of information that are generally equivalent to a username password, but it's really an application identity of some sort and an application key. And you have to configure those as part of your site so that when the OAuth token comes in, after the user's gone off and authenticated with them, you can validate that token and do that with the provider itself. So they kind of stub out the code you need here to plug those things in after you go out and do that separate registration. And they've got some stubbed out code in the view templates and stuff to be able to light up the buttons to send the user on their way to go authenticate with those third-party providers. Okay, so that is, you know, just a quick look at what's the new ASP.NET identity system and how does it tie into your MVC project. If you choose that individual user accounts, it's already pre-wired for you. It's a fair amount of work to go wire it in manually yourself after the fact. Okay. Let's jump back over here and talk about SignalR. So there are other sessions totally dedicated on SignalR as well. I've got a link to one, and I'll show you here in a bit. Those have already happened, though, so can't direct you to go see them live, but they will have the sessions online off Channel 9 site, so you can go watch the full sessions after the fact. In general, what Signal are? Well, you already saw it in action with Browser Link. So Browser Link, this bidirectional channel between Visual Studio and the browser, is really just a Signal R channel. And I should have showed you when I went through that demo, but the way it happens is that if you go look at the bottom of your page, when it gets rendered out to the browser, you'll see a couple of script includes that get injected in there for you by ASP.NET, and they have Signal R, or they have Browser Link in their names. But basically what the browser link is doing is setting up a SignalR channel. So what's a SignalR channel? It's basically the client has to still come and connect to the back end through an HTTP request and open a connection. But then SignalR is able to basically treat that connection as a persistent connection. Now, it's fairly smart and adaptive about the way it goes about doing this. So how many people in here have done WCF callbacks? And how many people have succeeded in doing WCF callbacks on the open web with clients in hotels, airports, conference centers? Probably no hands. So, you know, callbacks were great for inside the enterprise, using TCP primarily, being able to have a back channel to the client, be able to push notifications to them, tell them to refresh their data, this record has changed that you're editing right now, that kind of thing. The place WCF callbacks totally broke down was they didn't cross firewalls very well. And even though they had an HTTP variant of it, it generally wasn't resilient to going across firewalls because it was still pushing information directly to the client. This goes the other way around and says you never really push directly. You're never opening a connection to the client. You're just using a connection that is available that the client made to the back end. Now, what they can do is have kind of a progressive fallback mechanism here. That they're going to try first and foremost to use WebSockets, which are the most modern variant. Basically, it opens the HTTP connection, it downgrades it to effectively a TCP socket, and makes it so it's now a bidirectional socket back to the caller, which can be a web browser. And that's another important thing to point out about this. A lot of talk, mine included so far, about SignalR is all very browser-centric. SignalR doesn't care what kind of client you have. It works great with mobile clients. It works fine with a WPF desktop client. It works fine with a Windows 8 Windows Store application client. So SignalR has SDKs available to be able to tie in from any kind of client that can make HTTP requests. And like I was saying, what it will do is first it will try to use a WebSocket. So it will make that connection to the back end. It will try to turn it into a WebSocket. If that fails, then it falls back and says, okay, what else can I try here? So it tries a technique called server-sent events that certain browsers support. If that fails, falls back and tries something called forever frame. If that fails, it falls back and tries something called long polling. And worst case, it can fall all the way back to the crudest possible mechanism, but totally transparent to your code. Are you there yet? Are you there yet? You got anything for me? You got anything for me? So it just pulls from the client on a timed basis, opening a new connection, asking for information, and closing it. But it makes it very transparent to your client-side code. The client can basically say connect, and that's the last thing it has to worry about, and then it has methods on the client side that can be logically directly invoked by the server side code. So very powerful mechanism for being able to push information to the client. You know, common scenarios are you're working with data, there's other people concurrently editing that data, you want to be able to tell a particular client the record they're trying to edit, you know, was just modified by someone else, or just refresh the collection of things they have in their data grid because someone just added a new record to that collection on the back end. I'll show you, you know, other more collaborative scenarios are also certainly an important scenario for this. So let's just jump to a demo of this and show you what the code looks like as well. So I'm going to switch over here and open a new instance here to this MooShape demo. So this is one of the stock demos that's available out on the ASP.NET site from the SignalR team. Let me fire it up so you can see the functionality first. And I'll copy the address while it's loading here. And we see a spectacularly functional rectangle. Okay, but what you can do with this, if I slap these off to one side, is you can see that we've got this communication between browsers is what it appears like. working down, da-da-da-da. Okay, so basically what you've got, and you know, certainly you can extend this in your brain to a collaborative whiteboard kind of thing, where you could put some kind of tool palette up there for the user using some JavaScript and client-side more single-page application type functionality. Let them pick, draw, type things, scribble things with the mouse or with a touch input. And near real time, it can get transmitted over to that other browser. Now, it's not a direct connection here between the browsers. It's really going from one client to the back end and then getting sent out to the other client. So let's take a look at what the code looks like to get that done. And you'll see it's not a lot. So what you define are these things called hubs on the server side. And there's a hub-based class that you derive from. And then basically, the minimal thing you do is you expose methods that can be called from a given client, and they can pass data in those calls. So they're really a web API at the end of the day. They're a web API that's going to be invoked by an HTTP request coming into that hub and to that method with a certain signature. Now, what you do in here is up to you, but generally what you're going to do is do something with the incoming data and then decide what you're going to push out to the other clients or some subset of those other clients. So inside of this method, because I'm inside of a hub, let me go ahead and stop debugging here. I could do something like this dot, whoops, gotta get inside the method would help. This dot clients. So you can see clients and groups here as part of the API, if that's readable up there. So clients basically represents all the clients that are currently connected from multiple platforms, multiple browsers, and so on. And you could just use that to broadcast out to all of them. Or you could go to clients, and then you can see all except one client, all clients, clients within a group or different groups. So there's a lot of fine-grained control you have here to say, of all the connected clients, which ones do I actually want to send a notification to? And now in this particular demo, it's a little obfuscated because you can see what it does is it calls this thing called a broadcaster. This is just, in this demo, what they have set up is this broadcaster class over here. And really what it's doing, you can see some timer type stuff here. It's just setting up a timer loop. So as opposed to sending a notification to all clients the moment a call comes in from one client, when the call comes in, it comes down to this update shape method, and it's just storing it in some member variables on this broadcaster. And then on a timer loop, it's going out just so that it's not, you know, a setup for a denial of service kind of attack. It just stores the information locally and then on the timer loop, and that's why you saw some lag there as I did this with the mouse. It's on a 40 millisecond timer loop. It's got to echo that out. You've also got certainly connection delays, you know, based on the network you're on. So that's why I say near real time. You know, if it's a life or death situation and, you know, it's critical that within a 10 millisecond window, the user or the every client is going to get that information, you know, this is probably not the best technology to do that on, nor would HTTP in general be. But for those kind of collaborative scenarios or just getting a notification out to a client so that, you know, within milliseconds generally, they're going to get that information and be able to react to it and refresh what they're doing, it's great for that kind of thing. So in this case, they just up above here, they're setting up this 40 millisecond timer loop. It's pointing to this method down here. And then you can see it's using that hub context, which it gets up above. This emphasizes the fact that anywhere within your site, so in the code behind or the controller code for one of your MVC pages, you could say, okay, the user just posted back this information. I'm going to go store it in the database, and then there can be these other clients out there that are dependent on the same info. So you can use a call like this to get a hub context, a reference basically to the living hub that's maintaining the state for all these connected clients, and then make a call to it to go push information out to those clients. So that's basically what's happening here. It gets that hub context, goes to all clients, actually all except, and you can see it's using a property that's on the data model that's coming down, so it basically knows who is the caller that just stored the most recent information. There's no use telling them again what that data is because they're the one that just produced it for you. So it just kind of shows the way you can optimize the calls here and only notify the clients that are applicable to avoid unnecessary calls out there. Now, the other part of this is notice this update shape call, and it's camel cased here. That is actually going to be using kind of the dynamic aspects of C# these days on the server side, and where it ends up going is where this stuff all gets hooked up on the client side. So client side, we can see this jQuery SignalR is kind of the root SignalR library you're going to pull in, and then you also see this SignalR hubs source reference. Now, this is actually a dynamically generated script file. When you start up your website here, again, you've got a startup CS here, and notice this app.mapsignalr. So I mentioned app.this, app.that in own space means wire in some new infrastructure or some middleware into the request processing pipeline. So one of the things this is going to trigger is to go out and find all the hubs that are defined within your web app and basically be ready to dynamically generate what amounts to a proxy file, a JavaScript proxy file for those hubs. So that reference it's pointing to here, you can't go find that on disk. It's going to dynamically generate that at runtime. Now, if you don't want the hit of doing that over and over again, you can certainly generate it once, put it out there as a static file, and let people reference that as an optimization. But if you go look at the source code of that, it will have a listing for each one of the hubs that's in your website, and it'll have the exposed API of that hub that the client's able to call into, and basically some helper code to make you call it in JavaScript. So you can see what it basically looks like is you set up a connection to a given hub that's coming out of that SignalR hub's dynamic script. And then you can hook up functions, basically, to say when that call comes in from the server side, remember the update shape call on the server side, this is the thing that gets called for it on the client side. So you just hang these functions off of the client object on that hub, and you're basically saying this is the destination for that message when it comes in, and whatever parameters that server side passes, it's going to be serialized to JSON on the wire, and it's going to come back out as a JavaScript object on this side that you can deal with in your handling logic. And in this case, you can see it's just animating the shape when that comes in. And then in terms of calling down to the server from your SignalR client, you can see it can use this connection hub. It gets things running by calling the start method, and it's an asynchronous completion with the done method here to initialize things. And down here is the actual call to the server side to update the model as you're doing your mouse drag operations. You can see it just calls update model. There's kind of a camel case to Pascal case translation that happens automatically there, but that's going to get dispatched to this update model on the hub. So that's kind of what it looks like end-to-end to use SignalR. You can see the kinds of scenarios that it addresses. You're using it for free anytime you're using BrowserLink. And great capability to keep in mind to add more interactivity and sort of freshness to your pages, especially as you get into those more longer living pages in the realm of single-page applications or just doing data binding and kind of client-side navigation and interactivity in JavaScript. All right, last topic here is the editor improvements. So we got just a few minutes left here. TypeScript, hopefully you've heard that announcement, is one of the things here with Update 2 of Visual Studio 2013. TypeScript is now formally released. If you haven't been exposed to TypeScript, TypeScript is basically a superset is the way it's described. It is JavaScript at the end of the day, but it's a compiled, you have a compilation process. So you write your code in TypeScript. And what it really does for you, especially as a .NET developer, is it takes the fact that, you know, living in JavaScript is hard as a .NET developer. You lose your static typing. You lose your formal object orientation. You lose your compile time checking. TypeScript gives you all that back, but at the end of the day, you're producing JavaScript. And it is JavaScript itself, so if you know JavaScript, you can write JavaScript, you know, kind of interwoven with your TypeScript, but you can have formal definitions of model object types and controller types and things like that that you're putting on the client side in JavaScript and get back sort of the more formal object orientation, formal type checking, and compilation time type checking. So it basically should reduce the number of errors. Whether you should start off, if you're, you know, brand new to JavaScript and you're using some client-side JavaScript libraries, should you start off right away in TypeScript? Opinions vary there. Personally, I would say learn how to write the JavaScript first and then use TypeScript as a productivity enhancement when you get down to doing your production coding. But you'll see other people will say just, you know, go straight to TypeScript because it's going to feel more comfortable and familiar to you as a .NET developer. HTML editor improvements, I showed just a minor form of that with the Bootstrap IntelliSense when I was adding classes earlier. You'll see the same thing if I, let me just switch back over here. Yeah, I got one whole minute. Let's just do this. If I jump in here and add a page. Oh, and just to show you, you know, a quick example of some TypeScript here, I just threw together a TypeScript example where I'm defining that shape model object that was being used in the SignalR demo has some X and Y information. You can see, as opposed to normal JavaScript, you have types associated with your variables. You have the concept of public and private. You have a formal constructor for your object. Probably most importantly for those who have done JavaScript is you can actually predict what this means. If you haven't done JavaScript, you won't get the joke, but this is a pain in the butt when you're doing JavaScript. It's no longer when you're doing TypeScript. And you've got the methods and properties on your, you can see these get and set on your TypeScript objects. The thing on the right here, just to point out, is more Web Essentials goodness, that if you're doing, if you've got Web Essentials plugged in, every time you save, it'll do dynamic compilation of that, and it'll show you what the equivalent JavaScript is over here. So especially if you're already familiar with JavaScript and you're trying to get used to TypeScript, it's also good, a good sanity check to make sure on, at the end of the day, it's the stuff on the right that's going to run in the browser. So being able to look at that and just kind of validate that, yeah, that's kind of what I meant, I just didn't want to have to type all that myself, is a good tool there. In terms of the checking, I'm kind of out of time. What I was going to show here is if you go into some HTML and say you were doing Angular, you could just drop in here and start up here at your HTML and start typing ng, and notice we've got Angular integration. We've got Knockout integration. So these common popular third-party libraries, we've got IntelliSense. There's features like dragging and dropping images into your HTML. It'll generate the image tag with the right source tag and things like that. All right, so let me just wrap up here. I'm keeping you from beer probably, and that's not a good thing. SAS editors, JSON editors. JSON editor, you can pull down and get schemas, and it'll give you IntelliSense on that schema. You've got PowerShell editors with color coding, so you're just getting a much richer editor experience for lots of different kind of file artifacts you'll be dealing with in Visual Studio. So with that, I am done. There's a number of other good sessions, like I said. Let me just point out Ida's session tomorrow. If I go to this, it's DevB 421 over in Hilton, L2, Ballroom A. Recommend that for a deep dive on the ASP.NET identity stuff. The demos I did here, if you go to tinyURL and the session code here, DevB359, I've got those demos out there. And then over here on the slides, I've got a number of other related sessions. Great course on MVC5 by Scott Allen in Pluralsight, and some other links there to some announcements this week. Thanks for your attention. Enjoy the rest of the conference, and please fill out evals.